choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Godspeed, John Glenn.
Roger, 0G, and I feel fine.
Can I be out? Okay, I'm out.
How does it feel for the United States to be the new record holder?
At last, huh?
When that baby lights, there's no doubt about it.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Hello and welcome. This is Michael Annis, and you're listening to episode 168 of the Space Rocket History Podcast. And now, Apollo 8, Lunar Orbit. We left off last week with Apollo 8 at the end of the translunar coast phase. It was almost time for loss of signal and lunar orbit insertion. One of the paradoxes of Apollo 8 was that the astronauts on their way to the moon were far less able to determine their status than the flight controllers on Earth. Craft's trajectory specialists were able to detect tiny changes in Apollo 8's path by measuring the Doppler shift in its radio signals. Even a tiny change in the frequency of Apollo 8 signals meant something to Craft's people. Their data was so good that when they plotted the curve, you could see a little wiggle in it due to the spacecraft's slow thermal control spin, barbecue mode. The trajectory was nearly perfect. Only two minor mid-course corrections had been necessary so far, and it looked as though Apollo 8 would get to the moon without making any more. Almost perfection. Meanwhile, a constant stream of telemetry beamed from the Apollo 8 to Earth, and it was picked up by the giant radio dishes of the manned spaceflight network. For example, mission control could tell whether the fuel lines in the SPS engine were as warm as they were supposed to be or frozen solid. And the reports from mission control were terrific. The fuel cells were functioning even better than expected. The computer was running like clockwork. There was plenty of maneuvering fuel left. Mission Control radioed Apollo 8 that they were go for lunar orbit insertion. The moment of truth, the crucial lunar orbit insertion burn, would come when Apollo 8 was out of radio contact with only themselves and their machine to rely on. If the firing went as planned, the radio blackout, because of being on the far side of the moon, would last 45 minutes. But if there was a malfunction and Borman decided to abort the mission, Apollo 8 would come around a good bit sooner than that. In mission control, Chris Craft's trajectory people would know how things had gone simply from the moment they picked up Apollo 8's telemetry. Strapped in their couches, Borman and the crew waited out the last minutes of a three-day journey. They all knew they were cutting it very close to aim nearly a quarter of a million miles across space to a world 2,160 miles across, zip just ahead of its leading edge, and go into orbit just 69 miles from the surface. 69 out of 234,000 left very little room for error. It was understandable that Borman's crew wanted something more than numbers to assess their accuracy of the path. Before the flight, the trajectory people had told them that they would not be able to see the moon as they came in. But there was one thing they would know, and that was loss of signal, often called LOS. This was the moment when Apollo 8 would slip behind the moon and lose radio contact with Earth. Once the craft was on its way to the moon, the controllers would be able to predict the time of LOS down to the second. If it happened precisely as Mission Control predicted, Borman's crew would know that all of the calculations were right. Here's the clip for the countdown of loss of signal.
Apollo 8, Houston, 2 minutes, LLF. Apollo 8, Houston, 1 minute, LLF, all systems go. Roger, safe journey, guys.
Thanks a lot, Chris. We'll see you on the other side.
Apollo 8, 10 seconds to go. You're go all the way.
Roger.
Borman watched the mission clock intently. At precisely T plus 68 hours, 58 minutes, and 4 seconds, he, Lovell, and Anders heard static in their headsets. He could hardly believe it. Right to the second. Here's a clip of Borman recalling the event in 2013.
And one of the important things on the flight plan was when we would lose communication with the Earth. Because as you go around the moon, the communications would be blanked out because it was S-band radar that we were using to communicate. And so that was a very critical point. We had never seen the moon, as John mentioned. And it was perfect darkness, and we're flying backwards, aiming 240,000 miles, aiming for a place 60 miles above the lunar surface. So I was watching that time very, very, very closely. And hoping that we were on track. And just at the minute we were a second, we were supposed to lose communication, we lost it. And I, boy, that's great. What a wonderful deal. And I said, we just lost it right on time. And Anders says, well, they probably turned the damn radio off.
The astronauts were running through the checklist for the lunar orbit insertion burn when suddenly the spacecraft was enveloped by darkness. Anders realized that they were deep in the shadow of the moon. As his eyes adjusted, he saw that the sky was full of stars, so many he could not recognize constellations. He craned his head toward the flat glass to look back over his shoulder where they were headed, and he noticed a distinct arc, beyond which there were no stars at all, only blackness. He realized this hole in the stars was the moon. Here's the clip from Anders.
Well, we, as Frank said and as John said, we didn't see the moon because we weren't supposed to look at it because the sun was sort of right behind it. Afraid it hurt, we'd hurt our eyes. But when we oriented the spacecraft going backwards along our path, just as we were cutting in front of the moon, like high schoolers trying to outrace the train in their jalopy and beating it by a yard, we went into the shadow of the moon, where we were both in the shadow of the moon from the sun and the shadow of the moon from Earthshine. And it was dark. I mean, it had been kind of just the sky was sort of a gray. You couldn't see stars very well, but it wasn't dark coming to the moon. But now it was black. There were stars everywhere. You couldn't tell which ones they were. There were so many. And I remember looking back and seeing all these stars, and suddenly there was this big black hole. And I got to tell you, the hair went up on the back of my neck, because that was the moon. And when we popped out of that shadow and relit our engines, we were in lunar orbit.
That was one of the major decisions we had to make, because, if we had any problems at all, we'd circumnavigate the moon and come back again. So one of the decisions, and what we had to do behind the moon with no communication with the Earth, was to, of course, light the engine to slow down.
Falling into darkness, Apollo 8 was pulled toward its rendezvous with the moon at more than 5,000 miles per hour. The spacecraft was turned so that its big SPS engine pointed forward into the direction of flight. Borman, Lovell, and Anders would need every bit of its power, because Apollo 8 would have to slow down in a hurry, or else speed right past its goal. It would take just 4 minutes to slow Apollo 8 to 3,700 miles an hour, slow enough to go into orbit. Inside the command module, Borman's crew set to work running through the checklist to bring the SPS engine to life. With 10 minutes to go, rapid-fire conversation in the jargon-rich language of spaceflight buzzed in the command module cabin as Anders called off to Borman each item on the checklist. Now I have a clip of what is supposed to happen with the lunar orbit insertion burn, and this is from Mission Control.
Apollo Control, Houston, 69 hours, 3 minutes, now into the flight of Apollo 8. Apollo 8 now traveling over the backside of the moon. Time of ignition for our service propulsion system engine burn, 69 hours, 8 minutes, 52 seconds. Some a little over 4 minutes away from this time. Apollo 8 will perform its burn in the guidance and navigation mode using the onboard computer and the disky, the display keyboard. To do this, the crew will key into one of their guidance programs on the disky. The service propulsion system gimbal is trimmed before the burn. Maneuver to burn altitude has already been accomplished. A good deal of data will be flashed on the disky, and then in the final 30 seconds, a countdown to time of ignition will come up on its face. Then at time of ignition, minus 5 seconds, comes what in effect is a final go, no go. The computer in effect asks the crew, may I proceed? To execute the burn, one of the crew, probably spacecraft commander Frank Borman, must punch the proceed key. So at 69 hours, 4 minutes, 55 seconds into the flight of Apollo 8, this is Apollo Control.
Now I have a clip from the flight recorder of the astronauts going through the checklist and then firing the engine for lunar orbit insertion.
I'm going to give you a go.
Point, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got 2 minutes to go.
Hey, you know, the one thing we found is we didn't go to trim.
Yeah,
it's
a trim.
It goes
to
trim.
Or zero. It gets to trim.
It is? Okay.
Unlit horizon. Boy, I can't see squat out there.
You want to turn off your lights? Check it?
Hey, I got the moon.
Do you?
Right below us.
Okay. It is below us?
Yeah. And it's,
oh my God.
What's wrong?
Look at that.
Well, come on. Let's
okay.
6906.
Stand by, we're all set.
213, 212.
Okay, 6906, 20. Okay, Delta V thrust A, normal.
Normal.
Translation land controller, armed.
Armed.
Rotation land controller, both, armed.
Armed.
Tape recorder's going stop.
At this point, the flight recorder was stopped. We'll pick up right after it was turned back on.
Look at that.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yep.
But you know, I still have trouble telling the holes from the bumps.
All right, come on. I'm going to look at that for a long time. 20 hours, I guess. Okay.
Coming up 0745. Disky should mark.
1 minute. Come on, you must watch what
we're
doing.
I'm proceeding on 99.
Standing by for engine on ignable. Proceed when you get it.
Okay.
Start your watch when you get ignition. Stand by for Delta V normal B.
Available.
Second, 2 seconds. All right, how's
everything? You got him. Pressure's holding good.
All right. Everything good over here so far?
Everything's looking good. That's four ball valves. Everything is great.
Okay.
Pressures are coming up nicely.
All right.
Everything is great.
The longest four
long burn. you hold good? Just a little bit in a row. Good shape. PC check. 100. UMS is counting down. Congratulations, gentlemen.
Yeah, 00. Analyzer's on time. Congratulations.
Yeah, we can flip it over too. Okay, bird 82 winner.
Thanks.
Bye, safe vector. Okay, got it?
We're in a 169.1 by a 6005.
Roger. Proceed.
Proceed.
00.
Go back to 2.
00 enter.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Okay.
We've got a 37 and then 2, though.
Bird 66 enter.
Bird 66 enter.
That's it. We got the flight plan. Well, we answered if they're meteorites, aren't they?
I don't see a thing. Where are we?
Looks like a big beach down there. Let me have a flight plan.
Holy cow, it's completely blank here.
Okay, Jimmy, you want to...
Do we got all the gimbal motors off on this?
Yes, sir.
In case all of that wasn't clear, here's what happened. With seconds to go, the computer gave its flashing 99 message, and Lovell pushed the proceed button in response. 4 seconds later, the engine lit, pressing the men into their couches. Slowly, acceleration mounted, but there was no noise at all, just a gentle vibration and a smooth, steady push. Anders scanned the gauges. Tank pressure, valve position, fuel quantities. Pressures are coming up nicely, he told Borman. Everything is great. Time seemed to slow down. Each man knew the engine must fire for the prescribed duration. No more, no less. If the engine shut down prematurely, or if it didn't deliver the proper amount of thrust, they could end up in a weird errant orbit. If it fired even a few seconds too long, Apollo 8 would lose so much energy that it would crash into the moon. By the 2-minute mark, the burn had begun to seem very long. 2 more minutes passed without mishap, and then Anders counted down the last few seconds. Borman knew the computer was programmed to shut down the engine automatically, but he wasn't taking any chances. At 0, he pushed the shut-off button, just in case. Shut down, Borman said. Suddenly, they were weightless once more. The astronauts ran through their deactivation checklist like clockwork. Lovell queried the computer for the dimensions of their orbit. They were circling the moon in an ellipse that ranged from 69 miles at the point above the far side to 194 miles at the opposite point above the near side. The SPS had done its work beautifully. Within a few tenths of a mile, the orbit was perfect. Here's a clip of Jim Lovell recalling the event.
When we looked at the computer, it showed that we were in the exact orbit. I think at that time it was about 60 by 160 miles in a sort of elliptical orbit to begin with. So everything on this particular flight up to now was working perfectly.
Apollo 8 drifted above the far side of the moon while 3 astronauts looked down at a scene of total desolation. It appeared devoid of color, apart from various shades of gray, with no atmosphere to soften the view. It was a scene of unreal clarity. Everywhere there were craters, smooth round bowls, misshapen gouges, gentle hollows, tiny BB shot holes in the gray moon, shoulder to shoulder, one on top of another. Large craters bore the scars of smaller craters. Here's how Jim Lovell described it.
But when we finally came into the earthshine, or the sunshine, actually, we came out, I think we were best expressed as 3 school kids looking through a candy store window. You know, the flight plan was forgotten for a few moments. Our noses were pressed to the glass, and we were all looking at those ancient old craters on the far side of the moon, which, of course, as you all know, we don't see from the Earth. And to see what they were and how they were, we were just 60 miles above the moon at that time. And I think that's one of the great impressions I've had in the first instances of actually becoming a satellite of the moon.
Anders described the moon as a big beach with sand darkened by the cold embers of bonfires churned up by a big game of volleyball, but now deserted. Lovell meanwhile got out the map and tried to figure out where they were. That wasn't easy. They were over a part of the moon where the sun was almost directly ahead and the moonscape was without definition, like a bleached rocky ocean. Finally, Lovell spotted a huge crater with a dark floor, like a mountain lake. That was Tikhonovsky's crater, named for the Russian scientist who had dreamt of spaceflight over a century before. Lovell recognized it just as soon as he saw it. Minutes later, Apollo 8 crossed over into the lunar near side. It took several tries for Anders to make contact with Earth. But once the high-gain antenna locked onto the signal, it was amazing how clearly Capcom's voice came through. Here's the clip.
Apollo Control, Houston, we're looking at engine data, and it looks good. Tank pressures look good. We have not talked yet with the crew, but we're standing by. We've got it. We've got it. Apollo 8 now in lunar orbit. There's a cheer in this room. This is Apollo Control, Houston, switching now to the voice of Jim Lovell.
By 60.5. Good to hear your voice.
Next, the astronauts were asked to describe their view of the moon.
The moon is a different thing to each one of us. I think that each one carries his own impressions of what he's seen today. I know my own impression is that it's a vast, lonely, forbidding type existence or expanse of nothing. It looks rather like clouds and clouds of pumice stone. And it certainly would not appear to be a very inviting place to live or work. Jim, what have you thought most about?
Well, Frank, my thoughts were very similar. The vast loneliness up here on the moon is awe-inspiring, and it makes you realize just what you have back there on Earth. The Earth from here is a grand oasis in the big vastness of space.
Bill, what do you think?
I think the thing that impressed me the most were the lunar sunrises and sunsets. These in particular bring out the stark nature of the terrain, and the long shadows really bring out the relief that is here and hard to see in this very bright surface that we're going over right now.
Frank Borman did not join his crewmates in their excited descriptions. He was more concerned with the health of his engine. In Houston, the engineers were poring over strip charts of data from the burn. Borman wanted to know, as soon as possible, what they found out, and he wanted Mission Control to give him a go-ahead for each new orbit. Otherwise, he would prepare to leave. Seen from Earth on December 24th, the moon was a ripening crescent. Most of the near side was in darkness, but that meant that almost all of the moon's hidden face, the dark side, was in sunlight. Inside Apollo 8, Bill Anders manned a pair of Hasselblad steel cameras and a 16mm movie camera. His goal was to record on film as many lunar mysteries as possible. His photography plan was packed with objectives, and Anders had gotten to work minutes after Apollo 8 reached orbit. Here's a clip on the photography plan.
Now, Frank was not a great photography fan, but NASA definitely wanted us to shoot the shots of the lunar surface, and they had a plan that greatly exceeded even my ability to follow. Jim was busy photographing along the flight path through the navigation system, and I was shooting right, left, I don't think we had a light meter. The NASA had calculated what the reflected light would be depending on our longitude, which depend on our time. And so I just checked the clock and I'd turn it F this or F that. And so we got a lot of good pictures of the lunar surface. Related to that, I had named a bunch of craters before the flight. Didn't ask anybody, didn't ask Frank. Picked a nice big one for him, slightly lesser one, and then a well-formed, a small one for me. And all the politicians that were involved, you know, the crater naming guys threw all that out. John, there ought to be an investigation. But I picked them, at least mine, so it was just over the other side of the lunar horizon so that we could see it, but nobody else from Earth could. So it wouldn't have been named, but we could talk about it. So I talked a lot about coming over Anders and photographing it, and Borman and Lovell and Gil Ruth, and I even named one after you, John. So,
Bill, the crater that named for you was actually named Tsiolkovsky, so I don't think, and the Russians got it ahead of you.
Well, interesting that when they finally did honor us and the Apollo 11 crew with actually named craters, and they had, of course, picked six Russians who hadn't even been there. They picked the one place in the moon in that double shadow that we couldn't see.
When Borman, like any tourist, asked to take a picture, Anders became the rigid one. He didn't want to take any pictures that weren't in the photo plan. Now, armed with his map and his checklist, Anders scanned the parade of craters searching for his assigned targets and whatever else might look intriguing. The command module was not designed as an observation platform. Only the two small rendezvous windows were reasonably clear, but the view through them was disappointingly restrictive. To make matters worse, the best maps of the far side, drawn from unmanned probe photos, weren't that accurate. Even though Anders thought he knew where he was, he couldn't find anything he recognized among the swells and hollows. And when he managed to get his bearings, it was all too easy to lose track in the scramble of setting up camera gear, changing film magazines, and switching lenses. At first, he hesitated to take pictures, but he decided if he was going to come home with anything, he'd better just aim the camera and fire away. By the end of the third orbit, 6 hours into the 20-hour lunar visit, he had already taken many of the targets on his list, but there was still a lot left to accomplish. The far side of the moon was turning out to be different from the place Anders had envisioned. Like most of the astronauts, he went to see the film 2001: A Space Odyssey when it opened in the fall of 1968. And somehow, through the weeks of training, poring over the unmanned probe pictures, it was still Arthur C. Clarke's moon that stayed in his mind. A place of drama, with towering sharp-edged mountains, cliffs, and cracks. Instead, he'd come nearly 250,000 miles to see dirty beach sand. It was a place of such unrelenting sameness, crater upon crater, hill upon hill, that to see it with his own eyes was almost anticlimactic. Anders realized with some disappointment that the moon was a less intriguing world than he had imagined. About that time, Borman rolled the command module until it was right side up. When the maneuver finished, Anders glanced out the window. "Oh my God, look at that picture over there." "What is it?" Borman asked. "The Earth coming up. Wow, is that pretty." Slowly, beyond the bleached horizon, a radiant half circle of blue and white emerged, ascending from the black sky. "Hey, don't take that. It's not scheduled," Borman said, seizing the chance to give Anders some grief about a picture that wasn't in the photo plan. But Anders wasn't listening. He called urgently to Lovell. Hand me the roll of color quick, would you? But Lovell was already joining them at the windows. Oh, man, that's great. Hurry, quick, Anders said. At last, he slapped on the color magazine and aimed the camera with its telephoto lens. Lovell was impatient. You got it? Take several of them. Here, give it to me. After telling Lovell to calm down, Anders snapped the picture. Are you sure you got it? Asked Lovell urgently. Yeah, it'll come up again, I think, Anders said dryly. The first witnesses to an Earthrise returned to their work, each carrying the impact of the sight. For his part, Anders had been so focused on photographing, observing, and describing the moon since they arrived that it had not occurred to him to look at the Earth. When it suddenly appeared, his overwhelming impression was how beautiful it was, even more so beside the barren face of the moon, and how very small. Here's the clip of the astronauts describing this event in 2013.
Well, we were in a 160 by 60 mile orbit on the first three orbits and going backwards. And so, you know, we never saw the Earth. We'd pop around and we're looking at the lunar surface and we were upside down. And so on the third rev, I believe, circularized. We burned the engine again, slowed us down even further to lower the apogee of the high point of the orbit down to 60 miles circular. And Frank then turned the spacecraft around, sort of like it ought to be, going forward. And we were coming around on this third revolution, and I was taking pictures over here. Jim was asleep. I'm not even sure what he was doing. And I think Frank yelled out, look, or something. And here was this gorgeous thing coming up over the lunar horizon, the backside of the moon, much rougher than the front side of the moon. And so, boy, there was a mad scramble for cameras. Each guy had one, started firing off. I was lucky because I had one with a long lens and color film. And I just kept snapping and turning the f-stop. And each of the guys took the same view but different size lenses. And it just so happened that NASA picked the one I took as the iconic Earthrise picture. But frankly, even though they both claimed they took it, they know who did. But I consider it kind of a crew picture.
Apollo 8 had been in lunar orbit for more than 8 hours now, and Borman was in need of sleep. He left Anders in charge of the systems while Lovell attended to his landmark tracking. Here, too, the computer did amazing things. Once Lovell had determined Apollo 8's position and entered into the computer, he had only to give it coordinates of the next target, and the sextant automatically swung to the right place. It even moved to track the landmark, compensating for the spacecraft's swift motion. The results were breathtaking. Lovell felt as if he was flying only a few miles above the surface. Peering down into craters, he spotted landslides, even a few boulders. To his surprise, he found he could see detail even in the shadows. If Anders found the moon less intriguing than he had hoped, Jim Lovell did not share his disappointment. Lovell's most important target lay on the near side of the moon in the eastern region of the Sea of Tranquility. There, mission planners had picked out a possible site for the first lunar landing. One of the main objectives of this mission was to reconnoiter East 1, as it was called from orbit. Lovell had studied the approach that a lunar module would make before landing and had picked out landmarks along the way. Some of them, the ones that had been discovered on the unmanned probe photos, had no names, and Lovell, following the explorer's prerogative, had named them. Now, as Apollo 8 flew over the Sea of Tranquility, Lovell was pleased to find the familiar craters and mountains so easy to recognize. Over East 1, Lovell searched for boulders and other potential obstacles to a descending lunar module, and he found none. The lighting conditions were even better than he expected. It seemed a fine place for a team of astronauts to try to land. With only 69 miles between himself and the moon, Lovell wished he were making that journey. Salutations from the foothills of North Carolina. This is Michael Annis, your host, and I wanted to say thanks for listening to episode 168 of the Space Rocket History Podcast entitled Apollo 8 Lunar Orbit. Space Rocket History is a proud member of the History Podcasters and the Tech Podcasting Network. I want to give a big shout out to all my longtime listeners. Thanks for staying subscribed and extend a warm welcome to my new listeners. I'm glad you're here. I want to give a big shout out to Andrew Chaikin, author of the book, A Man on the Moon. And today, we salute the second most popular contribution level. That would be the Mercury donors. Mercury donors give $20 or more during the calendar year. Thanks for your continued support, Mercury donors. Okay, a little business from last week. I was corresponding with Dave down at Aussie HQ, and he thought we should have a moment of silence for whoever had to clean up the Apollo 8 capsule once it got back from the moon. And I agree. All right, let's take our moment of silence. Okay, thank you. I feel sorry for whoever had to clean up whatever was left over in Apollo 8. Oh, boy. Well, how about that? Three Americans in orbit around the moon in December 1968. Absolutely amazing from where the U.S. started out to get there by 1968. Amazing. Congratulations to NASA and all the contractors. A fantastic job on a nearly perfect flight so far. Do you ever get the feeling that this group of brilliant, driven, and determined people could do just about whatever we asked them to do? I feel that way sometimes. If there was any lingering doubt about who was ahead in the space race, it should be over now. But there is one task remaining that will have to be completed. And you know what that is, landing on the moon. Now, did you notice that when the astronauts on that recording I had of them on the just with the flight recorder, they seemed to have had part of their procedure to shut down the flight recorder for a while just before the lunar orbit insertion burn. And that was kind of surprising. I feel like we missed something. I guess it was part of the procedure. I mean, they were clicking off things and doing stuff, so I guess it was just part of the procedure, but I feel like we kind of missed something. I'm not sure why they had to turn the recorder off. Anyway, a listener, Fraser W., sent me a link to a musical video that is appropriate for this episode. It's a British duo called Public Service Broadcasting, and they incorporate extracts from historical recordings into their music. And they have a track called The Other Side, which is about Apollo 8. It's from the perspective of Mission Control when Apollo 8 is on the dark side of the moon and they are anxious to get radio contact back and check that the lunar orbit insertion burn was successful. Now, I put the link to the video on the homepage along with some pictures, so make sure you check that out at spacerockethistory.com. Moving on, I was pleased to receive three donations to support the podcast over the past week. Christopher T. from the UK donated at the Vostok level. Thank you, Christopher. Matt B. pledged on Patreon at the Mercury level. Thank you, Matt. And Andrew R. pledged on Patreon at the Apollo level. Thank you, Andrew. That brings our Patreon donors to 57. Sadly, we lost one Patreon donor last month. Our overall donors for the year are at 129, with a goal of reaching 250 by the end of 2016. Now, to stay on pace for reaching 250, we will need 17 more donors by the end of July. That is a difficult task. Folks, historically, the summer has been a slow period for donations. The podcast could really use your support at this time. You may recall from last week I mentioned the $300 computer bill I had to pay. Well, that takes a toll on a low-budget podcast like this one. The summer is really a slow time for donations, so if you are able to donate, please do so. It doesn't have to be a lot. You can make a one-time Sputnik donation of $5, or you can make a minimum donation of 50 cents per month at Patreon. If you think Space Rocket History is worth $5 a year or 50 cents a month, please go ahead and support the podcast. Now, to make a donation, to make a one-time donation, you will click on the orange donate button on the homepage. It's on the top right at spacerockethistory.com. Or, just below that donation button, there is a link to Patreon. If you want to sign up there, that'll be fine too. All donors are rewarded with their name on the donors page on the website spacerockethistory.com based on their donation level. To stay updated on the podcast, including previews of next episodes, please follow me on Twitter, and the handle is at SpaceRocketHist, and on Facebook, and the link to Facebook is on the homepage at SpaceRocketHistory.com. I want to encourage everyone to share the podcast. Feel free to link the homepage or a particular episode on all social media, and thanks to those who have already done so, like my retweeters. Jet City Star, 1202 Alarm, Ashley James Lee, Atherin, ATM Int Arch, Bert at Home, Bonner to You, Buddy P. Murphy, David B. Nugent, Duke of Oil 60, Futurama King, Glenn Trudgett, Jacob Hahn, Keith Drankwine, Gaddafi 1202, KHS Astronomy, Pompeiator, Rapid Mustang, Skibby, Stephen Lebowski, Stiggy, This is Alex Boyd, Tomasino 1202, Tarul, Chris Towers, and Ray L. Riv. I appreciate it. If I missed anyone, let me know and I'll get you next week. This is the end of content for this episode, and I had a few off-topic thoughts. If you're not interested, please feel free to switch to the next podcast. Thanks for sticking around, folks. I hope you enjoyed that episode. Next week, we will continue with Christmas Eve on Apollo 8. In podcast news, I thought I would give a few more statistics. Last week, I gave you the top 10 countries for downloads, and I would like to give you countries 11 through 20 for downloads in the month of June 2016. At 11, Austria, 12, Switzerland, 13, New Zealand, 14, Spain, 15, Belgium, 16, China, 17, Romania, 18, Italy, 19, Poland, and 20, Denmark. I want to give a big shout out to everyone in those countries and say thanks for listening. In listener news, I was excited to learn that one of our new donors, Matt B., works at SpaceX. Now, of course, I'm a big fan of SpaceX. I watch all the launches and all the landings. I'm on the email list, and I even follow them on Twitter. I am hoping to get a chance to see a launch next year sometime. Anyway, Matt offered me a tour if I'm ever in Southern California, so I hope I am able to take him up on that offer sometime. So now the podcast has listeners in the ESA and SpaceX. I have heard from some people that worked for NASA previously, but I haven't heard from anyone that is currently working at NASA that listens to the podcast. So if that fits you, if you're working at NASA and listen to the podcast, slip me an email and let me know. I'd like to hear that. And tell me what you do at NASA. In personal news, hope you check out that song video link that I put with the episode on the homepage. It's a YouTube video, and I thought it was pretty good, and I want you to check that out. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm looking forward to the new Star Trek movie. It comes out in the U.S. on July 21st. Boy, I hope they did a good job on this one. I had a few issues with the last one. It was called Into Darkness. It seemed to be a remake of Raft of Khan. But don't get me wrong, I liked it. I'm pretty easy to please on science fiction movies. If a movie is going into space and they have a spaceship, that will automatically get you, the movie, a 3-star rating out of 5 on my scale. So I give Into Darkness a 4-star rating. Now, the one they did back in 2009, I would give that a 5-star. It was really good. Anyway, I probably will go the Tuesday after the opening, since that is the cheap seat night. Okay, that's about all I can think of for this week, so I hope to have episode 169 up by next Thursday. So long for now.